It is good to see everybody this morning, especially to see Cindy, who I haven't seen in some time, and to have your mother with you this morning. That's a special treat for us. On Wednesday evenings for the past few weeks, we've been looking at the book of Job. And Job was a man who lost all of his external props in life. He lost his income. He was bankrupted in a very short period of time. He lost all of his servants. All of his children were killed in a freak windstorm. He lost his health. He lost the help of his wife. She was no help meet to him at all. And he thought he had lost his God. He lost his friends. They came and sat with him for a week, said nothing. And when they started talking, they only added to his agony by trying to convince him that he had committed some terrible sin. During all of this suffering that he undergoes, Job gives expression to some of the deepest needs that humanity, you or I, will ever face, ever express, ever articulate. And maybe the first one in the book is found in chapter 9, verse 33. And I like the way the Old King James translates this verse. This is where Job says, "There is no daysman between us that might lay his hand upon us both." And the word daysman referred to a mediator, a go-between, someone who could stand between two parties and bring them together. And Job says, there's no one to relate me to God or to relate God to me. No one who can lay his hands equally on both of us and allow us to come to common ground. And maybe the way to think about this statement of Job's is to think about me going to Dunkin' Donuts. I'll go from Job to Dunkin' Donuts. The Dunkin' Donuts in Rantoul is owned and run by Indians. And they are hard workers. But I can barely understand them. Their first language is Hindi, not English. And they've come over here to work and they're trying to understand English. But if I walked in one day and said, would you fix me up with a decaffeinated light roast with froth oat milk with a puff of whipped cream, they'd look at me like I was from Mars. They'd have no idea what I just said to them. And they say things to me and I don't know what they're saying either. What is needed, what I need, is a translator. Someone who understands Hindi, someone who understands English, and who can help us understand each other. Now, I've got a friend in Champaign, a good friend, who grew up in India. His parents were Presbyterian missionaries, and for the first 18 years of his life, he grew up speaking Hindi outside of the home and speaking English in the home. I want to get him up to Rantoul some morning. I doubt that he's up at 4:30 in the morning when I go to Dunkin' Donuts, but I'd love to get him up some morning to where he could just talk lickety-split to them in Hindi and translate for me, but I don't have that. I need a translator at Dunkin' Donuts. And Job says, there's no daysman. There's no one to translate God's ways to me, and here's the more profound thought, there's no one to translate my ways, man's ways, to God. Christianity is the only religion that dares suggest that omnipotence, divine omnipotence, somehow or other made God incomplete. Job couldn't understand where God was coming from, and he suggested that God didn't understand where he, Job, was coming from. And I don't think Job was being blasphemous in that, because God answers Job. There are questions raised by Job in his book that are answered by Jesus in the New Testament. Job says there's no mediator. And we turn to the New Testament, we read there is one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. And this morning from Hebrews chapter 2, verses 5 through 9, that I'm going to read here in just a minute, we're going to be talking about this mediator. So if you'll turn to Hebrews chapter 2, I'm going to pick up here with verse 5 and read through verse 9. This is going to be the text for our study this morning. Hebrews 2 verse 5, "For he has not put the world to come, of which we speak, in subjection to angels. But one testified in a certain place, saying, What is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that you take care of him? You have made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor and set him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. But now we do not yet see all things put under him. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone." Now, this lesson this morning is going to be more doctrinal than exhorting. There are times in the epistles of the New Testament where chapters are given over to the doctrine, the nuts and bolts of God's plan of salvation. And then there are chapters that exhort us to do certain things, to respond, to act, based upon the doctrine. Well, this morning is primarily going to be doctrinal, where we look behind the scenes to see what was going on with God in the redemption of men. And there are two parts to this section. The first is found in verses 5 through 8 that we could refer to as man's abdication and ruination. Man abdicated the place God put him and ruined himself as the result. Then in verse 9, and verse 9 goes into verse 10, but I'll save verse 10 till next week, we have Christ's incarnation and propitiation. So man makes a mess of things, and then God comes to clean up the mess. That's the way to understand the two points this morning. So let's begin by looking at verses 5 through 8, which is a quotation from Psalm chapter 8 for the most part, where the shepherd boy David, you know, shepherds had a lot of time to spend looking at the sky. They're out there by themselves in the evening with the sheep, and they lay down and they've got that whole expanse of the heavens. They're not near any big town. They're away from all the lights, so they can see the Milky Way and all the stars and the planets as brightly as they can be seen. So David had a lot of time to study the heavens, but his observation of the heavens led him to a thought. He begins out talking about the magnitude of the heavens. What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you take care of him? Now, the writer does not quote the verse before where he begins quoting. Back in Psalm chapter 8, verse 3, here's the verse that precedes where the author of Hebrews begins quoting Psalm 8. Psalm 8, verse 3. "When I consider your heavens, the handiwork of your hands, the moon and the stars, what is man that you are mindful of him?" When I consider the heavens. You've seen those color pictures of the nebula out in the sky that they've taken, those great gas clouds with all the colors of the rainbow in them. And they're just massive. They're huge. They're hundreds of thousands of millions of years away from us. And yet, our telescopes can take pictures of them. If the Earth was a 6-inch ball, right here where I'm indicating it, excuse me, if the Sun was a 6-inch ball, right here, Earth would be a speck of dust at the door here coming into the yard. 50, 60 feet away, Earth would be a speck of dust. I'm just staying in our solar system, not going beyond that. And we are less than a speck on a speck just in our solar system, not even talking about all of the galaxies that exist off into infinity. When I consider the heavens, the handiwork of your hands, the moon, the stars. What is man? From a physical standpoint, man is next to nothing. But here's what the Bible says about this next to nothing speck on a speck. Four things are said about him. And Psalms 8 lists him. Number one, you have crowned him. A crown is something a king wears. And in crowning us, God is not pretending that we paupers are really princes. In crowning us, God is really crowning us. He's treating us as royalty. He's saying to us, man, of everything I've created, up in the sky, around you on earth, in the seas, of everything I've created, you are royal. Nothing else falls into that category. God crowned us with glory. Now we came across this word glory in chapter 1 verse 3 where we read that Jesus was the brightness of God's glory. And in that sense, glory is the light from the lights. We've got these light bulbs up here. And because of that, we have light in this room. The light in the room here is the glory. And even though the light in the room is not the light bulb, even though a sunbeam is not the sun, the light is of the same character. We have a glory that is true of the royalty that God has made us. He not only has crowned us with glory, He has crowned us with honor. Honor is respect shown someone. Honor is responsibility carried out in regard to someone. Children, honor your father and your mother. Elders are worthy of double honor. We have been put into position where everything else in this universe does honor to us. And the fourth thing said about us is namely that everything else God created was placed under man. Everything was made in subjection to us. I've seen statues of the T-Rex. I don't know if there's ever a more fearsome creature that God ever created to walk around on earth than a T-Rex, Tyrannosaurus Rex. But when God originally created those T-Rex, they were as tame as a kitty cat in the presence of man. There was nothing God created that was out of control. Man had dominion over everything. All the animals were tame originally. And the ground that man was sent to till and to care for produced abundantly. I mean, the first thing God does when He curses Adam because of Adam's sin is to make the ground not as fertile as it used to be. And I can sympathize with Adam. I planted some grass seed this year around that. I don't think a single seed germinated and came up. Now I'm wondering, what have I done wrong that I grew up on a farm and I can't even grow grass I scatter around? Or flowers? No. Everything originally was under man's dominion. But the very last phrase of chapter 5 verse 8 changes everything. But now we do not see all things put under Him. The world we live in is not like the world God created. The way things are now is not the way they were then. Bears and lions and tigers can be tamed, but those who have tamed bears, lions, and tigers have all also been eaten by the animal they tamed, or killed by the animal they tamed. And I scatter flower seed and nothing comes up. No, things are different now than they were in the beginning. And the writer expects us to understand what he's talking about. There in verse 8, between the verse that goes, He left nothing that is not put under Him, but now we do not yet see all things put under... The writer expects us to understand that a tragedy occurred between those two sentences. The writer of Hebrews expected the people reading this letter originally to have some Bible knowledge. That's why back in verse 6, when he's introducing Psalm 8, he doesn't say, now back in Psalm 8, verse 4, what he says is, but one testified in a certain place. And the author of Hebrews expects his readers to know who that one was. It was David. And to know where the place was, it's Psalm 8 that he's going to quote from. He presupposes these people have some Bible knowledge. And he presupposes that they are familiar with Genesis chapter 3, where man sinned. And because of the curse God placed on man because of sin, everything changed. Instead of everything now being under man's dominion, more often than not, man is under the dominion of other things. We've made some strides in bringing parts of this universe back under our dominion. We can fly like the birds now. We can live up in the Arctic. We can live at the equator. We can live under the sea, at the bottom of the ocean, in certain limited ways. But in many ways, we have not made any strides in getting all things back under our dominion. And one of the most obvious is in regard to death. When David wrote the Psalms, he says, you know, most men have 70 years. There are some who have 80 years. And that's not changed much. I mean, that 70 to 80 years, that takes care of most of us. I've gotten to 70 and I've got friends, it seems, every week, another friend, a contemporary of mine, they're having a funeral for him. We've not made any progress in regard to that. Oh, we may have added a year here or a month there, but we've really not changed where things were in the time of David. And it's because of sin and the curse placed upon man, man abdicated the place God put him, and he brought ruination to himself and to this planet. Man sinned believing that if he did so, he believed the devil's lie, believing that if he did so, he'd be more like God. Because of man's sin, he's even now below the animals. Man is capable of living worse and acting worse than a wild animal. I saw a headline this morning. I don't know what happened. They had a soccer game over in Paris yesterday. And the home team won. And the fans just about destroyed central Paris last night with fires and rioting. And the headline was something along the line, the barbarians are in Paris. The barbarians, not the civilized. Paris used to be the epitome of civilization. The barbarians have taken over. And that's what happened because of man's sin. So, note the contrast between verse 8, verse 9. But now we do not yet see, verse 8, verse 9. But we see Jesus. Job, there's no daysman, there's no go-between, no mediator. God says, well, I'll take care of that. And now we see Jesus. Now, how do we see Jesus? We see him by faith. Faith is the eye of the inner man, the spirit. And by the spirit, we're able to see what we're really not seeing physically. Christ said of Abraham that he saw my day and he rejoiced to see me. Abraham saw the Messiah by faith. And when we get to Hebrews chapter 11, there's going to be an entire chapter there about what we can see by faith that can't be seen any other way. Faith is the evidence of things hoped for, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Moses endured by seeing him who is invisible. And God made us capable of seeing with our spirit what we can't see with our body. And it's what we see with our spirit that's to make a difference in the life that we live. And so, let's look at verse 9 here. But we see Jesus. We losers, we sinners, need to understand that we can't fix our own mess. The mess we have made by our sin, we cannot fix. We need somebody else to help us fix it. And Jesus is that person. He's the go-between. We see Jesus. 1 Peter 1:8, Peter says that you love Jesus even though you've not seen him. But again, by faith, we can see him. And what do we see when we see him? Well, four things that the writer mentions here in verse 9. We can see his incarnation, his humiliation, his exaltation, and his propitiation. We can see Jesus in his incarnation. He was made a little lower than the angels. That means he became a man. Look back to verse 7 when David is talking about man in contrast to all of the cosmos that God's created. David says this about man: you have made him a little lower than the angels. Now, you made him higher than the animals, but physically you've made him a little lower than the angels. Angels in terms of their sheer, if I can even use this word, physicality. And that's not the right word to use, but that's the only one I can think of. In reference to the angels' physicality, they are superior to man. One angel, a single angel, destroyed all the firstborn of Egypt. A single angel killed 185,000 Assyrians besieging Jerusalem in one night. In terms of their power and physicality, we're no match. We're made a little lower than they, is how the Bible puts it. And so when we read that Jesus was made a little lower than the angels, that means he became a man. And that's what the word incarnation means. The Word became flesh, John 1:14. And part of the reason the Word became flesh was that God might learn to speak our language. That God might understand what this creature He made actually goes through in living life. And because of Jesus being made man, becoming flesh, being made lower than the angels, He is the perfect mediator for us in interceding for us with God. So we see His incarnation. Secondly, we see His humiliation. He was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death. It is men who have a physical body who die. In order to die, Christ had to take on himself a physical body. That involves suffering. Not just dying, but the suffering of death. All of the terrors we deal with in regard to our approaching death, Christ endured all those, went through all those. He understands what it means to be scared of dying. He understands all of that. And so in his humiliation, in being made a man, he was God. Everything that God is, he was God in heaven, and he left that, Paul says, Philippians 2, and came down here and took upon himself no reputation, made like the servants we are, that he might die. But his humiliation was followed, number three, by his exaltation, because after his suffering of death, he was crowned with glory and honor. He was given the glory, the honor that was given to man in the beginning, Psalm 3. He was exalted. He now has the name that's above every name. But at His name, every knee should bow. Humiliation, exaltation, and most importantly for us, propitiation. That He, by the grace of God, might taste death for every man. And I'm not sure what all that means. That He might taste death. I think there's an Old Testament figure who helps us a little bit understand what that means, and that would be Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 1 verse 11 tells us that he was the cupbearer to the king of Persia. And to be a cupbearer didn't mean you were a butler who walked in with a drink for the master. To be a cupbearer means you often sipped the drink before you gave it to the master to make sure nobody had poisoned it. Christ, however, in becoming man, tasted death. He tasted what we're facing. He tasted what many of our former members have already known. What it is to die. And here's what Jesus said. The first thing He said after His resurrection, the very first thing was, "Fear not." Before His death in the Garden of Gethsemane, He is shedding, He is crying, He is weeping, He's pleading, "Let this cup pass from me." Sweating, as it were, great drops of blood. That's before, but afterward, "Fear not." I'll tell you, before I had my first dental implant, I sweated almost drops of blood. And I may have cried a little, I'm not sure. But I mean, there have been situations that I did not want to go through. And I was glad to talk to someone who'd been through what I'm going through. And someone who would say, "Don't worry, it's nothing. It's nothing." That's what Jesus is saying. He's gone through the worst experience we'll ever know. And He says to us, "Fear not. It's nothing." So let me conclude with summarizing some of the things that this text has to say. And again, these are doctrinal things that we're going to build on as we get farther into the book of Hebrews. What's the central happening of these verses here this morning? Well, that Jesus died. His mortality. He who was God became man and He died. Why did He die? In order to suffer and to taste. In order to suffer, to bear the penalty of sin. In order to taste, to experience what we go through in our death. What was the nature of what He did? Well, verse 10 gets into this. I'll just mention this now. He did this because it was fitting for Him. I think the King James says, verse 10, it became Him. It behooved Him. It was fitting for Him. You know what that means? That means what Christ did, He did because He couldn't help it. Being love, He couldn't help it. He could not do what He did. When you love, there are things you would do that you would never do if you didn't love. Nobody could make you do them. But when you love, when a mother loves a child, I've read about mothers rescuing children from the jaws of alligators down in Florida. And put it, 98-pound mothers taking on a 10-foot alligator that's got their baby in its mouth. And mothers who've done that couldn't help it. That's the way love is. That's the nature of love. And Christ, in becoming a sacrifice for us, that's who He is. That's what love does. Jesus never did anything He was forced to do. He never did anything because somebody held a gun to his head or twisted his arm behind his back till he said, "Uncle." Everything he did was consistent with his nature. His nature being love. And what's the result? What's the rest of the story? Well, let me jump ahead here. The rest of the story, verse 10, is that he's brought us to glory. The rest of the story, verse 14 and 15, is that he has delivered us who have been terrified by death. He's delivered us who through fear of death were all of our lifetime subject to the terrors of death, and he's taking us to glory. That's the end of this story. And that's what a Christian has to look forward to. If you're not a Christian, you don't have that to look forward to. What you have to look forward to is worse, far more terrifying than anything you could ever imagine in this life. But if you're a child of God, what you have to look forward to is far more glorious, grander, greater, better than anything you can imagine in this life. And it's all because of what Christ did in dying for us. And so we'll leave it there, and we'll pick up with this next week.